Okay, so two topics I want to touch upon today that can be related at times. One is the correlation of angular momenta, so it's a correlation of rotation axes of disks, both how to model it theoretically and how to find it in the universe and what we found. And the other one is gravitational lensing, which is usually measured by a induced alignment of galaxies. So if you assume the first effect doesn't exist, you can measure the second effect. And then it's been popular to ask in recent years, how big each of these effects is, and how you could convince yourself that one of them does or doesn't exist, and how to discriminate amongst them. Let me start with the, despite the order in the title, let me start with the alignments of galaxies. So, at least in the near, for most disk galaxies, they have quite obviously flattened and rotating. They have quite an obvious rotation axis. And so when you look at the sky, you actually see at every position of every galaxy a little rotation vector, the vector fields. The spin field of galaxies is like a vector field on the sky, a 3D vector field that you can measure. And you can ask, are there correlations in this vector field, or is this are they completely uncorrelated and various things? So the basic questions that people have asked, it's an obvious question to ask, and people have asked this for, I don't know how long galaxies have been around, but for quite a while. I guess since, who was it, Chapley? Who was it who said that galaxies were galaxies?
Well, there was a lot of work by people and some students looked at this pretty closely. People prior to that claimed some correlations. Peebles and Hawley.
That was some scanning the plates. No.
Well, it was. Yeah, it was based on plate material.
And the obvious questions you can ask is whether neighboring galaxies might have correlated alignments, both whether you might expect it and whether you can find it. If they are aligned, does it tell us something useful? And could this be a potential problem for the goal of doing statistical weak lensing on measuring? Could this be a source of contamination for other things people are trying to do? So I started this actually with a postdoc, Junghong Li, who was in Taiwan at the time, who asked me for a project to do related to halo dynamics. And I suggested she look at the statistics of halo correlations. And she did a quick literature search, and it turns out there's been no shortage of papers trying to measure correlations of galaxy alignments. So typically, at any given time, there will be one or two papers claiming a two-sigma detection. And a few years later, it would go away when the next bigger catalog came. And then the next catalog comes around again, you get another two-sigma detection, and it keeps going away. So at any given time, there was there was usually one or two claims of having a detection that never held up.
This is not lensing detection, but just intrinsic.
This intrinsic statistics.
One detection has from
the Bengali effect.
Bengali
of ellipticals.
Giant CDs.
Giant CDs are correlated, but the here I guess I should say by galaxies I mean the spin axes, rotational axes of galaxies, have not had a convincing statistic. I mean, there have been many statistics that have been very marginal, and to our surprise, there have been zero theoretical papers estimating how big an effect you might expect. That was about 3 years ago, which we found very surprising, since you would think, this is an obvious question you could answer in a simulation or even by perturbation theory. So we said, well, that's probably a fun thing to jump into. And you can even start looking, obviously, there are always newer catalogs out, and we can write another crackpot paper claiming another two-sigma detection. If we apply more than 20 statistical tests, I'm sure we'll find one which gives us, we can repeat that game all over again. So that's clearly a very fruitful subject for dubious research. And anyway, so then we jumped into it, and it actually turned out to be a lot of fun. Just stating the obvious that, but the history of some of, this, of the ideas behind it, as I showed in the picture, it's quite, these galaxies have quite an obvious rotational axis. Okay, it's something very easily seen, easily measured. That being the first question you might want to ask is what the origin of rotation of angular momentum was. There have been various ideas, strange ones, not so strange ones, by quite well-known people. And the first qualitative concept, well, I guess Hoyle had a paper in the 50s, very, very vaguely talking about tidal talking, but the first cosmological picture that had the right idea was Dorashkevich, 1972. There was a paper by Peebles in 69, which unfortunately turned out to be misguided. Well, people said that at first order there is no angular momentum because protogalaxies are spherical, so you cannot torque a sphere. So you have to wait for the back reaction. You have to wait for the back reaction of the tide to distort your galaxy to torque it. But Dorashkevich realized that protogalaxies probably are not spherical to start with, and therefore there's a first order effect, not a second order effect. So Dorashkevich probably had the first modern concept of how angular momentum came about. And Simon White in 83 was the first paper that we found which actually put numbers to the statement, you know, how you can actually estimate how fast things rotate. So I think the 83 was the time when this business got into a quantitative framework. Now all these things only asked about the origin of rotation of one galaxy, okay, single galaxy, ignoring what the other galaxies are doing. And nothing had been done at that point about how the angular momentum of the two-point, so this is all talking about one-point statistics of spins. The two-point statistic just hadn't been asked before, strangely enough. Now, review. Basic undergrad mechanics. Tidal talking is a basic picture as to how you generate angular momentum. Simplest picture is the Earth being tidally possessed by the Moon. And just recall the basic ingredients, but you need to exert a torque with gravity. You have to have an aspherical object, like the Earth, is flattened by rotation. You need an inertial quadrupole, that's non-trivial. And you need a tidal shear, gravitational shear field acting on it. And these two tensors, the inertial tensor and the shear tensor, have to be misaligned. Okay, so the principal axes cannot be aligned, otherwise you get no torquing. In the Earth, it happens to be the case because the Earth's rotation axis is offset by the Moon. Well, not a very useful picture. Let's just review what this. I think the picture is just the obvious. How you actually do anything? Let's just review how we do tidal torquing of any object by any gravitational field. So by definition, the angular momentum of an object is rho, integral of rho r cross v. Integrated relative to the center of mass, where you define it. Here, I should fix this. The time derivative, the talking of it, the time derivative, if we assume that the only thing which has a time derivative is the velocity, being the torque applied to the object doesn't change shape while you're doing it, then the time derivative of velocity is acceleration, which is, in this case of gravity, given by the gradient of the gravitational potential. Now, if we expand this relative to the center of mass, okay, you're assuming that we're following an object inertially, then the gradient is zero, so we just sit in the inertial frame of the object, so this actually is zero, it's the center of mass frame of the object, and then you can expand the gravitational potential as a Taylor series around the center of mass of the object, where it's zero, and the Taylor, there's no zeroth order term in the inertial frame. And the Taylor expansion of this guy just throws out one more derivative. So you get the second derivative of the gravitational potential. And then this is now constant, the Taylor series. And just integrate the density over the over two variables. And this is the definition of the inertia tensor of a object. So very straightforward algebra. The torque on an object is just the matrix product of the tidal shear times the inertia tensor of the object contracted with a level Civita symbol. So in particular, these two have share principal axes, and you can rotate yourself in the principal frame, and this contraction always gives you zero. So that has, that's how you get the requirement of having misalignment. And you also, what you need is, you need this product has to be asymmetric. Both of these are symmetric, and the product has to be asymmetric for this to have something left. Okay, so let's try to, let me first talk about what we did to measure it. Well, I called up Brent Tully. Actually, I bumped into him in a hallway, and asked him, you know, do you have some galaxies? Do you have a catalog of galaxies we could play around with to play this game? And he says, of course, he's got a catalog with everything we wanted: distance, position angle in the sky, inclination angle, Hubble type. So, and so he'd even tell us whether it was this galaxy or not. We didn't have to actually look at any real images ourselves. The perfect data set to try to play this game for the nth time and try to find, you know, some marginal detection. And of course, this catalog was built for some other purpose. Doesn't really matter. Here's just a pictorial plot as to what this thing, what this catalog looks like. So he gives us distances, so I can take cuts in distance. This is a surface plot of galaxies. Obviously, it's not drawn to scale. And he tells us basically the apparent inclination, apparent position angle and inclination of every galaxy. So we can reconstruct the rotation axis by this is what the catalog looks like. You see they are fairly inhomogeneously sampled. Obviously, you don't see them where the galaxy is. This is a very incomplete. The catalog doesn't have any useful completeness criterion as far as I could tell.
Does it have distance? Does it have redshifts?
Redshift, yes. They all have redshifts.
He tried to argue this catalog was complete in some way, that some distance, like, or some redshift, like 3,000
kilometers. Yeah, it's based on RC3 and some thousand thing. And he says that there are regions in it which are probably complete. But
it
really
doesn't look
but there's certainly a region.
Of course, with an experienced plane, they're going
to. But in our case, of course, if all you care about is the relative alignment of galaxies, as long as the selection doesn't depend on the inclination angle, which it might actually, but as long as your selection effect function doesn't depend on how they aligned, you can still play the game of correlating spin axes. Okay, so just play this game. That's the obvious that everybody has done before. You plot up. This thing is, not plotted here, is the cosine of the angle of the vectors between them, the expectation value of the cosine squared or something like that, of the angle. So this is just the, project one vector onto the other and just see what you get left after you're doing it over an ensemble. And you can see the signal is very small. Relative to one, right? So this is a if it's perfectly aligned, this statistic would give you one. So this is clearly nowhere close to one. This is the as a function of separation between galaxies plotted in redshift, but doesn't really matter. This is divided, whatever. This is as a function of distance, so that's about a megaparsec in the first bin. So if you like to play this game, this is about a 2 sigma detection of alignment. One sigma error bars. It all comes from this point, and this point is just over 2 sigmas. And if you average the rest in, you get a nominal just over 2 sigma combined detection of alignments from this catalog, and you can go into history as having written the n plus first marginal detection of galaxy alignments, which we did. Now. There is one difference, though. One thing we added to this plot, which was never added before, which was the theoretical prediction from an n-body simulation. Okay, we measured the spins in an n-body simulation and saw how well they correlated. And it's a black curve. The black curve is in redshift space, so it's what in real space it's this dash curve. It actually drops fairly rapidly as a function of separation, but because you don't really know how far apart galaxies really are, this is the curve to compare the data points to is a solid black curve.
That's for dark matter halos?
Yes, for dark matter halos.
How do you, that means you need to know which galaxies are going to put spirals in your
head? I don't know. I just took all halos and call it.
And you just took all halos and then looked at their axis.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's very
okay,
cool.
Right?
There's no reason to believe that this is good to factor of two.
Okay.
There's no reason to believe that this is good to factor of two. But it's an order of magnitude guess, right? I mean, before the people previous claims were, you know, much higher than this, obviously, because people were working with much smaller samples. So to see it, they all claim, you know, the detection set has been going down monotonically over time. But on the other hand, you know, you'd be surprised if the disks were much more correlated than the angular momentum of halos. I could see that they might be less correlated, but you know, it would be surprising if disks were much more strongly correlated than angular momentum of halos in general. At least it's something. It's a number you can plot up. And quite surprisingly, this number actually lies fairly close to this two sigma detection, okay? So at least it says it's not crazy. At least the simulations aren't totally crazy. And on the other hand, if we had seen a signal much bigger than that, then we would say, you know, this is unlikely to be, you know, this would be even less likely to be true than it is. Okay. So, anyways, yeah, we are splitting hairs on bad statistics. Similarly, people can ask, you know, does the spin, how does the spin axis correlate with the direction of the nearest neighbor? And this is even less than two sigma, even less than one sigma detection on that one. So, and again, in the simulation, you expect to see nothing, and you see nothing. It's amazing what you can get away with publishing these days.
In the FJ.
But then we said, well, okay, this isn't getting us anywhere. So let's try a more theoretically motivated approach, okay? Instead of doing just this standard correlation, plus even if you found something, you never know whether it wasn't some statistical systematic, because, you know, who knows how we select those galaxies, who knows why those galaxies were selected, and who knows a lot of things. It is possible that, you know, people might preferentially have face on galaxies in your catalog when they're fainter than they are when they edge on them. I don't know, it's quite, you know, like, could well be such selection criteria. So it's even if they do correlate, you really have no idea what that's coming from.
How do you deal with the sign ambiguity on the spin? I mean, you got an object, you see edge on or someone edge on, you don't really know where the spin vector is up or down.
I used it as a spin. I used the magnitude only. I didn't use the sign. Okay, so you say, well, let's be a theorist, and we say that we can do better than that. We can actually, if we knew the distribution of all matter in the universe, we could calculate the tidal shear field due to all the matter in the universe at that point. And then we can predict how the galaxies should line up. Okay, so very straightforward. All you need to know is all the matter in the universe, and then you predict how they all line up, and you compare it. So in principle, this is a straightforward procedure. The only question is, how do you know what the matter is doing? And generally, you don't. But there is a standard thing which seems to work reasonably well, actually, is to use galaxies as tracers of dark matter, of matter as a whole. And on large scales, it seems like this may well be a reasonable assumption. And the popular one is the best, most complete catalog for this purpose, if you want us to get the nearby whole sky, nearby universe, is the IOS PSCZ. It happens to have a depth comparable to the Tully catalog. So this is the catalog we thought would give us a nice, good estimate of the best we could do. It's not good, but the best we could do of shear. So here's 15,000 galaxy redshifts. So it's comparable, both in number and in depth, to the Tully catalog. And you know, the distances. They don't tell you actually the alignment of any of those, strangely enough. So you couldn't actually use them. But that's okay. So now you're cross-correlating two different catalogs. So at least you've got, you know, you hope that whatever systematic is in one is not shared by whatever the other catalog has. So it's at least something completely different. And from this, you reconstruct the reconstruct the Wiener-filtered shear field out of the density map.
What scale is that? What's the smallest scale that happens?
Well, the Wiener-filter effectively cuts out everything below about 5 megaparsecs. So it's a characteristic of the Wiener-filter, and it's distance dependent on how you away from us we are.
So it degrades with pressure.
It degrades. It's far away. It has less than.
Could you use bulk flows, or are those two forcefully trained? I mean, you know, people have bulk flows of velocities and stuff, which also tell you.
Well, there are a couple of ways of getting bulk flows. One way of getting bulk flows is to just do the same game we have, right? If you know the gravitational potential, you just construct a bulk flow out of it, which is exact same. That's the exact same game we're playing. The other thing people do is they measure using Tully Fisher, using rotation curves. They try to get the peculiar velocity of every galaxy. In fact, Marcus is a major player in this game. But that was not a great word of confidence of that one. But I think just pretty statistically, though, the statistics as well of such a reconstructed velocity field is noisier than the density field that you would get if you believe that mass traces light. This has a lower noise.
So at every point, you calculate the shear field
of all the galaxies.
But you're probably just dominated by the nearest handful. Is that true? Do you really need? Galaxies that are far away are not going to impact
it. Not any given one, but not right. But the large scale structure does. So the cluster out there, a filament there, if you middle play,
so
play relative
say,
to the void.
You cut it off at 500 megaparsecs. It'll actually, you'll get a different result.
No, you won't. I mean, you can calculate how fast it drops off. It does drop off, yes. It turns out how quickly it drops off depends on your power spectrum. And it turned out, yes, you are dominated by the Wiener filtering scale. So the nearby ones are just too noisy.
So if I change it from 5 megaparsecs to 4, or to 7, that will change.
That will change.
But the sample, the Poisson noise of the sample, and the fact that you don't really believe the galaxies trace the mass on small scales with enough precision, you really can't go to smaller scales.
Right, but it means, how much confidence can you, since the answer, well, I guess you just look for a signal.
Yep, that's right. Okay, so let's play the game a couple of different ways. You can ask, the null hypothesis is that galaxies are aligned randomly relative to the gravitational shear field. Okay, that's a testable, the null hypothesis is testable. Everything is random, and that gravity is not related to the alignment of galaxies. So that thing, in that limit, if they're unrelated, I know all statistics perfectly. I know that galaxies are isotopically distributed in the frame of the local tidal shear field. And you can disprove that hypothesis at quite a number of sigmas. I don't know what they correspond to, 4 or 5 sigmas. So that's the randomness is not possible. Okay. So even if you screw something up, and whatever you screwed up, it's still not random. And just to show what this actually looks like, so here's again a slice. The red ones are the red crosses are the PSCZ galaxies. The green circles are the, I think I changed notation here. The green circles, the green and black concentric circles are the Tully galaxies, okay? And you can see that once in a while, the same galaxy appears in both catalogs, but most of the time, strangely enough, these are different galaxies. Even though they're the same distance and have a similar spatial density.
If they're comparable in number, why do you assume that the second one is a better tracer of the matter than the
Tully? Oh, the PSCZ is selected with a objective flux limit, so they know the completeness, and they can guarantee you that we have an X percent probability of seeing a galaxy. With Tully, just the gravitational field is dominated by how good the weather was when they looked at something. It's
The other point too is this infrared selected samples are unaffected by extinction, so you can use them barely to construct an unbiased sample, except for the confusion zones in the galactic plane that they had to give up. But that's why they've been so useful.
But I think Gary's question is, how do we know that the IRAS galaxies trace the mass when we're missing all the mass apparently in the Tully galaxies?
Well, they're a noisy tracer of the mass. You have to
smooth.
Focus your eyes to a certain degree.
That's just defocus here.
They're very much shot noise limited.
In your earlier poll, you show the IRAS catalog that there's CAD on the galactic
Well, the IRAS go much closer to the galactic plane, as Mark was saying. They don't have suffocistic extinction. So this is a plane here. And near the plane, you only see IRAS galaxies. And then at the very plane, you still don't see anything. And then further out, you start seeing Tully galaxies.
So this is not galactic coordinates?
No, this is ecliptic coordinates, I think. Don't ask me. Anyways, to give you a thinner slice so we can actually make a more closer cartoon figure as to what you do, is so given this shear field, the green ellipse is the most likely alignment of the galaxy given the shear field. Okay, so you predict, you make a prediction. At every point, I can predict how every tiny galaxy should have lined up, and the black ellipse is how it actually lined up, how it actually aligned. Okay, so that's the raw product out of this analysis, and you predict, you know, some set of alignments, and you measure some set of alignments, and you ask, you know, how good is that prediction? It turns out actually very noisy. Per galaxy, the signal to noise is very small. But collectively, as I said, you rule out that those two things are random at some incredible statistical confidence. Okay, and that's because you have a completely independent way of predicting these alignments.
And you're doing this with all the redshift information.
With all redshift information. 3D map, 3D everything. Just to give you, to put a number to it, isn't this horrible? To get a number out is what you mean by how correlated a vector is to a tensor. I've got to quantify now. I'm giving it a tensor field, a spin 2 field, and I observe a spin 1 field, I observe a vector field as well, and I say, you know, how can I talk about correlations? You know, what do I mean by that? It turns out one of the simplest correlations you can put in, one thing, by the way, is we said we don't observe the magnitude of the spin. Okay, first of all, it's very hard to tell the mass or the speed of those things. So the direction you can measure very easily. The magnitude is hard, so we just forget. Ignore the magnitude or the sign for that matter.
Sign as well.
We ignore the sign. Well, as you said, we don't know the sign. So if you want to have anything left, you better construct a quadratic thing out of your vector. Otherwise, the sign symmetry will make that zero if you don't know the sign. It turns out the sign actually depends on relative alignment that are impossible to predict as well. You can neither predict nor observe the sign. So let's just forget about the sign. So you take a quadratic product of your angular momentum vector, a unit vector over here. And you can write that as the most general quadratic expression of your shear tensor. Okay, you say, well, you just multiply the shear tensor with itself, and then requiring that, you know, these traces to unity, there's only parameter you can have is you can have some strength of alignment relative to the shear field, and there's some whatever you need to make things add up to one. And it turns out in the noisy dominated limit, there exists an optimal estimator for this correlation strength. And the way it's done is you write the spin axis in the principal component coordinate system of the tidal shear field. Okay, I use my three axes as my three coordinates as my basis for my spin vector. And then I sum up each component squared, weighted by the eigenvalue of that principal axis of the tidal shear field. It turns out, at least in perturbation theory, that this gives you the best estimate of the minimum variant estimate of this correlation strength. Some magic formula that comes out. And we have the magic formula coming out, but because that's something I can plot up from the data, and something I can measure in an n-body simulation, in principle, like that you can tie things together that way.
Sorry, on the previous thing, so you're saying that if the component that's aligned with the shear field is then weighed in more heavily, is that right?
The major axis is weighed in more heavily than the intermediate axis, for example. So the weights depend on how aspherical the tidal shear field is. It basically says, you know, the tidal shear field is almost round, it's hard to tell, and so on. But it weights things by how obvious the direction in the tidal field was.
So if there's a strong shear, then you look at the component of angular momentum in the direction where that shear is happening, and you weight it.
Yeah. But there's three components of the shear. The shear has three axes, so you have to weight all three of them by some set of weights. That turns out to be in some limit. There's a limit in which this is an optimal thing. I won't go into details. You can read our 30-page paper on why we argue that is the best thing to do. Even if it's not, it's something you can do. And then what we do is we plot up this parameter, and the R here is just a radial binning. Okay, so these are all locally measured quantities. So this is all, you know, you always measure the galaxy relative to its local shear field, and we can cut the data up into galaxies that are far away, galaxies that are nearby. So it says that, you know, at far away things just get very noisy. I have very few galaxies, so I don't know whether those galaxies really line up relative to the local shear or not. In the intermediate range, I get some alignment. And nearby, where I have the best statistics, we actually find that it's actually random. Okay, so the nearby galaxies, we don't actually see an alignment by using that statistic relative to the locally reconstructed shear field. Now, okay, there are a couple of ways you can ask the question. If you ask, therefore, what can I measure A to be? Then, you know, there's no single consistent value of A I can get out of here. But I can ask the question, if A was truly zero everywhere, what's the chance of getting these outliers? And that's very small. Okay, so you rule out the hypothesis that all galaxies are random everywhere. That probability you can calculate, and that's completely ruled out by these alignments here. Now, what's happening nearby, I don't know. But, you know, I can hypothesize that we use a Wiener filter. So, which means that you shrink your smoothing scale the more galaxies you have. It just, the noise just comes from short ones of galaxies. So it's not clear that shrinking, and then the noise, the errors, you know, we get depends on how much we smoothed by. And it's not clear that we actually do better. You know, shrinking, it may get noisy. You know, first of all, things are non-linear, and it's not clear that the Wiener filter is the right thing to have done on those scales.
Can you, I'm a little confused. How do you typically interpret A?
A is the alignment strength of a galaxy relative to the local shear field.
So that's a correlation. You haven't actually defined it. You talked about how to optimize it, but you didn't say.
Well, that is the definition. That's the definition.
I go with that.
Yeah. Sorry. So I mean, what is the other axis? I mean, then why is there on the plot you were just showing just what distance? Oops.
Different samples, different
sub-samples.
Yes.
But doesn't this just say that no constant value of A is consistent?
Yes, it says that you cannot get an error of A out of this sample easily, at least. But it also rules out that A is zero everywhere.
Well, it rules out that A is anywhere.
Global value of A. No, but the random hypothesis is that, you know, if they're random, then A should be zero everywhere, and that's not the case.
Right.
Okay, so you've shown that there is some correlation with gravity. So spins are not everywhere random. That you can rule out.
Well,
now how non-random they are is a different story because we get different numbers. But again, this is difficult. The corners is much harder to interpret because, you know, it's a fairly complicated smoothing window we use. That it's not clear that this one not being a signal, it could be due to a million things. It doesn't mean that tidal talking theory broke down. It just means that our mechanism of trying to correlate it didn't turn up anything. Okay, so.
So the R is the size of your bin, the area of your local region?
No, we take all galaxies. So let's take this bin over here, okay? I only take the Tully galaxies whose distance between from us is between 50 and 75 megaparsecs. I only consider those and their alignment relative to their local shear.
So I suppose you put everything together, you'd essentially get the zero and the small error. I mean, maybe there's no reason that this should vary with scale, with distance. And so what do you get when you take all your data together?
Well, you can't because it's inconsistent with coming from one sample.
No,
yeah, there's no...
So there's a physical interpretation for what you're saying.
Yes?
You're passing through the Perseus-Pisces structure in those middle channels. And that's a long filament, which will have a strong tidal shear because of that. And what you seem to be seeing is a lot of the galaxies have their major axes
aligned to that.
Aligned to that that direction. And that won't necessarily be the same locally. because there isn't an equivalent filament.
But A is supposed to be the strength of, if you have a tidal shear, how strong will you get the angular moment to correlate?
Yeah.
So A should not depend upon this unless there's a nonlinear feedback.
Well, things are nonlinear. And the other problem is that the size of the error bar that goes comes only from the number of tiny galaxies you have in each bin. Included in it is not how big an error I made on the shear estimate, because I don't know how long the shear is. Now, they're all correlated, right? So the nearby galaxies, if I got the shear field wrong, then they all give me the wrong answer. So I formally get a very small error bar, but they're all correlated. So the null hypothesis is fine, okay?
You're more likely to have made a big error on this on local scale than out far because you have more sample.
Exactly. And the volume is tiny. I mean, if a volume weight this, this bin should get no weight at all. There's no volume down here in the nearby bin. So if you know, if all I have to do is make an error on what I think the shear is locally in the nearest 50 megaparsecs, 50.
So did you plot it up volume weighted?
Well, if you plot the volume weight, it just basically goes away and just sees those guys, right? So that's why I'm saying it's not the interpretation of this is not straightforward. But on the other hand, you know, the thing which we do show is that the null hypothesis you can deal with very easily. The converse, what if you reject it, is not obvious. Okay. This is basically what we said. The null hypothesis is rejected by no matter how you cut it. Okay, so there is a correlation between galaxies and tidal shear somewhere. And as I said, it's not clear how you combine it. And now we can ask other questions. Now what? What's next? And what can you do with it? Well, a couple of interesting things that come out of it. First of all, we've seen that you do spins correlate with the gravitational tidal shear field. If they correlate, you can turn it around, right? If I can measure the spin axis, I can, in principle at least, reconstruct the gravitational shear field out of which they formed. It goes both ways. And of course, you measure the shear field when the galaxy is actually formed, so, I mean, you measure something somewhere. But the nice thing about this is that you get a three-dimensional map because you have distances to galaxies. At least in this sample, you do, and in principle, you have distances. So in principle, I can use this to get some dynamics of the gravity, and therefore construct. I can in principle use this to construct the three-dimensional gravitational shear and therefore gravitational field and matter field, just by looking at the galaxy spin field.
But you can do it directly.
If you knew that light phase is mass or something.
Yeah, well, you're going to measure the sun. Certainly, that's the least of your problems, if light traces mass. But you can do it directly with the 3D galaxy distribution in the sun survey.
Of course.
It's tidal field. It generates tidal field.
I mean, we can play this game, of course. I mean, obviously, you do that. But, you know, as you have been heavily involved, one of the big things people always have been trying to do is see whether you can use a dynamical, purely dynamical, measure of gravity without any assumptions to construct the same thing and compare those two. Right?
Well, you're also going to reconstruct the 3D shear field as it was at redshift 5 or 6.
Yes, when this gets formed.
As opposed to now.
And just statistically, so when we try this out in a simulated sample, you should get quite high signal to noise on the reconstruction if you have a complete survey of both the density and size as Sloan. Okay, so this is just by the strength of signal we've seen already. Remember, we already have a fairly strong detection. If you multiply the sample size by 100, then from 5 sigmas you get a fairly significant map.
What do you learn from the 3D shear field?
Oops. I got ahead of myself. It's like saying you get to learn what the gravitational distribution was doing at some redshift. If you for the real skeptic, you know, the skeptics who believe for the devil's advocates who say that galaxies might not be related to anything in their spatial clustering, you could actually show that the gravity. That galaxies are the primary form of gravity, do trace the matter. This is a.
I don't see how you. I mean,
The correlation is never overwhelmingly wonderful. Why you think you can trace it, why it traces the past and not the present, it's true that it traced that it came from torts in the past, but all those things are evolving slowly. The tidal field is changing amplitude, but it's not changing in a gross way with time.
Right. Right.
So I don't know that it tells you anything about the past more than some scalar types.
Sure, no,
it's the present torts.
Yes, that's right.
In fact, you were looking at the present shear field and the present alignment.
Yeah.
So.
That's right.
If you were really sensitive to what it might have.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? That today's shear field is a reasonable estimate of the shear field then. I mean, that's what this is saying. But it is a way of constructing it. Purely kinematically, you can construct the gravitational field. Let me try to say a little bit.
Galaxies don't process in the shear field.
No, they don't. Okay, let me talk just a little bit about how this relates to gravitational weak lensing, for which this is a source of contamination, potentially. Let me just show you the picture of the kind of the Vilmos data sets. This is the blue circle, I'm told. I didn't take this picture. It's the size of the moon on the sky. I don't know where this in the sky this is, but it's the size of the moon. The moon probably never passes through this patch anyways, but anyways, this is the field we're looking at, which I guess is less than a degree at this measure. So you zoom it up and you see all these nice faint galaxies. You zoom up once more, and the things of interest is you look at these hundreds of thousands of really faint guys at redshift of one, and you sort of measure the shapes. And the game that you play by measuring the shapes is you can ask, those shapes get sheared by gravity. And again, the cartoon picture of that is that if you start off with galaxies in the background and the shapes, the light as it propagates is grossly exaggerated, but the light gets deflected by matter on its way. So when you see the apparent alignment of galaxies, they have been distorted by the intervening matter, and if the matter is correlated spatially, then the apparent alignments will be correlated spatially. So that's a straightforward effect. And what you can do from it, the correlations you can measure. So we've published an angular power spectrum from this data set. And there are two things you measure, actually. Okay, you can measure two power spectra. It turns out that with gravity, all gravity in the Newtonian limit comes from a gravitational potential scalar. And the thing that you observe is a polarization vector, is a spin 2, is a polarization field, the spin 2 field, which has two dynamical degrees of freedom, popularly called E and B modes. And under lensing, it should only be able to excite or induce one type of mode in the correlations. So we're plotting up the two different types. The top here is the E type that should be induced by gravitational lensing. And then you can also measure the B type correlation, which is not induced by gravitational lensing ever. Well, not at least. People have estimated how big it is. It's tiny. Okay, it's 50 more orders of magnitude down. So it might as well be zero for all astrophysical purposes. It is, however, a good cross-check to see whether there's something else causing distort correlations or causing telescope optics, all kinds of things could do not have the same separation of these two kinematic modes. And I think the good news is that, at least on the angular scales where the signal peaks, the gravitational signal is strong, we don't seem to be at least overwhelmed by the contamination mode. And you can ask, well, but what do you expect? Do you expect a lot of contamination? Is the contamination expected to contribute a lot to the B mode? And you can ask, well, does this mean anything? Let me just show you a cute picture of what the raw data looks like. So this is a field about 2 degrees by 3 degrees in the sky. I think that actually in arc minutes, on this one. And what I've plotted here is a Wiener-filtered shear field. Okay, so normally it's completely noisy. Every galaxy is just pure noise.
Maybe you're going to get to this, but so the correlations that you were talking about before, the intrinsic correlations.
Yes.
You you wouldn't expect to be mailed for that even again?
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
I hope. But here's what you observe. Okay, you observe this shear field on the sky, heavily smoothed and filtered. And again, as I said, there are two modes. There's a curl and a divergence, or E and B mode in there that you can actually measure. It's pretty noisy, so the trick is to measure those things.
What's that smooth? Scale that smooth?
Well, it's Wiener, so it's about, I think, 2 or 3 arc minutes is the characteristic length or scale that the filter picks for you.
By 700,000 unknowns.
Well, each galaxy is a vector, right? It's the two numbers per galaxy as the vector field. So the computational problem of making this map is 700,000 cubed, if you do it brute force, which nowadays it's a little bit expensive if you do it brute force, so we don't do it brute force. But this map, actually, I never found these maps incredibly enlightening because I've got a hard time taking a curl of a noisy map by eye. So we can have a computer do that for you. And you can make out of that the previous map. I can have it reconstruct the expected dark matter distribution on the sky. Okay, this is a Wiener-filtered dark matter map on the sky. What you're looking at is white means a lot of dark matter. White means it's very dark. And again, the signal-to-noise per point in the Wiener-filtered map is around 1. Okay, so half the things you see are fake, are noise. And I'm not going
to...
Oh, that's just something I did for some other statistics test. The white points are the peaks. So on every positive peak, I put a black point. Every negative peak, I put a white point, just to confuse things. Yeah, exactly. And anyways, this is the dark matter map that you get constructed out of this procedure.
So dark matter.
And some of the gaps are stars that bleed. Some of them are airplanes flying over your exposure. These are galaxies that were cut out. These big black blotches are nights when, for reasons I certainly have no idea why they do that, but the infrared CCDs apparently have fringes, get fringing on them, and they just throw away the data on that chip.
So they could go back and fill in a bunch of
them. They never were able to do fringes. So it must have dropped below a threshold of data quality when it was adopted.
So
you can see on the upper left, you can see the footprint of the camera. This is Lupino's 12 chip array, 2x6 array. So you can count 6 on top and 6 on the bottom. That's 1 point of his instrument.
And then they didn't move.
No, they didn't. That's why, in fact, they don't even know
how
those fields
came out. All of the gross distortions in the optics.
Well, let me show you. You don't. Here is the.
No wonder they got this data processed so quickly.
So I can play the same game. This is in the same field. I can count galaxies, right? This is a surface density plot of luminous matter. Okay, so this is dark matter on the sky. That's luminous matter on the sky. Now, are they correlated? Well, a little bit. And if you saw these two flashings, maybe you could see a little bit of correlation. Statistically, actually, it turned out to be quite painful to try to measure that, because you see that some areas are just much darker than others. Okay, this is much darker than this one, and that's because I plot galaxies above some threshold in magnitude, but the calibration doesn't exist. So you cannot calibrate across fields.
I'm unable to calibrate the data from this instrument.
Exactly, you cannot calibrate the total counts. So in fact, the surface, the large-scale features in the plot just tell you about the, I don't know, atmospheric transmissivity of that night in Hawaii or something.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's there's data, and there is a new survey coming along, the legacy survey, which is supposed to deal much better with all these issues and have much more area. We have also a new way of measuring the angular power spectrum. The previous plot you saw was a quick and dirty trick by measuring a correlation function and inverting that. It turns out originally the basic computational cost goes as 1 million cubed times a fairly big p-factor, even when you do that. which just seems like a lot of work. But meanwhile, we have a new technique that can do this in n log n instead of n cubed.
This is for the galaxy distribution or the shear?
For both, it works for both. The galaxy distribution power spectrum, I plotted it for myself. I'm too embarrassed to show the galaxy power spectrum on this plot. But this is, again, the lensing part and the non-lensing part power spectrum that you get by maximum likelihood estimation using a new technique that we have developed for...
Is it 3,000 to 4,000?
Pardon? That's at 2,000? 3,000? Why this one goes down? You're asking, is this top real?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been trying to make it go away so far. No, really, you can use the binning, right? And I thought, well, we bin this thing, but I haven't quite.
Like that doesn't look like binning.
But I couldn't make it go away by any obvious binning choice. Oh, but by the way, the error bars here are Gaussian, so if there's some non-Gaussian structure in it, it could. I don't know. I'm not sure that this is a big problem yet, but this is formal with formally Fisher matrix error bars that appear for a Gaussian theory. If you take Martin White's numbers, just multiply them by 2 or something on those scales, isn't it? In which case, they're not quite as inconsistent anymore. And they might be correlated with each other or something. Yeah, anyway, so that's something that that you can. Anyways, what we're plotting here is the dark matter power spectrum. Okay, it's the projected dark matter power spectrum. It's now measurable. I think that's always a neat thing. You can actually measure it directly.
Yeah.
Now, on the same plot, unfortunately, with totally different units and totally different conventions. That's what happens if you have collaborators from different parts of the world or different communities. We plot up, that's basically the signal you saw in the previous plot. Anyways, here is the expected contamination just in total power from the lensing strengths for various parameters of this A, this correlation strengths that you might expect. And we see that for medium redshift of 1, you don't really expect this to be a big effect. Assuming A is constant with time, assuming all kinds of things, but this should be kind of trivial. In a trivial effect. At low redshifts, it could get bigger than your lensing signal. And just to make it quick, there are these two modes. And in our calculation, we have we ask, what is the relative contribution of this signal to the two types of modes? And we find that they're almost the same on all scales. And I'm sure Martin's going to disagree with me in a minute, but in our model, at least, we find that this kind of contamination does give equal contribution to both the E and the B power spectrum. So you would see it. Not seeing an E in this model, at least, means that there is no contamination. Okay. In fact, I think Martin here is an author on a couple of these papers. There have been various other papers written on this that I don't have time to go into, so I have a good excuse to skip over everything Martin White has said. And I will just conclude with my view of what I claim we have now concluded. Is that I think we have a case that at least in many places, galaxies are really spun up by gravitational tidal fields. Okay, direct confirmation of the tidal Hawking picture that they correlate with that. Also, I think it's interesting to see that the first both n-body calculations and direct measurements of the strengths of these alignments are consistent. I mean, I think we don't know anything the factor of 2, neither in the simulation is known data, but at least in the same order of magnitude. In fact, within a factor of 2 of each other, which I thought is quite a comforting set that, the whole picture, I think, is a consistent one that we probably have. This probably is what's happening, right? Tidal shear is spinning up galaxies and so on. you know, and that's being correlated, we can use them as a probe in principle. And the questions we set out to ask, do they contaminate? For the deep ones, probably not. In the existing data, probably not, at least not a lot. And I was also was surprised that despite the fact that 3 years ago there were zero papers written on the subject, it's been mushrooming over the last 3 years that I don't know why everybody all of a sudden started writing papers on spin-spin correlations.
Or you was trendsetter. Are they all your papers?
Was it the last ITP cosmology workshop? Wasn't it 3 years ago at the last ITP cosmology workshop?
Yeah, I think we had some discussion in the last workshop on this topic. Okay, thank you.
Let me just ask a question back a few slides. On the shear estimates from the CFH data, are you getting power that's consistent with other measurements?
Amplitude?
Yeah. The amplitude? Consistent with other reports in the literature?
Well, we get, you know, if you calculate that in the sigma 8, it's high, right? This gives you a sigma 8 of 0.9 or something if you normalize the power spectrum out of it.
Other weak ones.
Well, by other, I would say short answer is yes. I mean, most other ones have much bigger error bars, such that, where is it? This was one person's scaling of putting the various data sets as of, I guess, a year ago on the common plot. The green ones are the measurements from the Wilmers data I just showed you. And the other guys are, you know, the various other groups that measure it. And sure, I mean, it's it looks consistent to first order. Now, if you actually put it in, obviously the mean differs by a bit, but within what we can tell, it looks similar. Yes.
So what you're looking at is the effect of the large scale, large-ish, meaning many megaparsec shear field on the rotation axes. But I would imagine that galaxies find themselves in groups and large groups and clusters, and that their local environment should have dominated. Is this not a surprising result?
Well, it probably does dominate. And remember that what we do, okay, so there's a couple of things. First of all, the local shear of the groups correlates with the large scale shear itself. And the actual measurement, and I took this figure out because always makes people less comfortable about the result. Let's put it back in again. Here's what we actually do to get such a large number. Okay, what we say is we know it should have depended on scales very close to the galaxy, but we observe the correlation relative to a much larger scale. So the thing you measure actually is very, very small. And then you put a big correction factor in because you say that I know that I have smoothed much more heavily than I should have. And in the Gaussian theories, I know how much that depressed my power. So I boost it up by that power. And that's a scaled result to compensate for that effect.
Presuming it remains a line. Mm-hmm. Presuming. In order to scale it, you have to presume it's just a line, but then degraded in amplitude.
Yes, but you can. But it should be in a Gaussian field. You can calculate how quickly it degrades, and they will be aligned. Yeah.
Does it have to be? The large scale. I mean, you've got a large scale filament.
Yep.
That may have a shear field pointing along its axis, and you've got a small group of.
Not well aligned. Statistically, I'm saying. Statistically, they're aligned. And statistically, you can calculate how quickly it decorrelates.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what goes into the scaling. On a given case, it could be totally different, sure.
So if you've measured a sigma 8 on the CFH data that's as large as you report, and you still think that there are problems in the data, then presumably sigma 8 is going to come down and correct some of those problems.
It goes up and down, actually. Some of the problems make it go up, some of them make it go down. As I mentioned earlier, we had a problem that the fields went the wrong place. You lose power by putting fields in the wrong place. You gain some power, whatever it is. Kind of moves around.
Weak ones in so far as measured with sigma 8 anywhere from 0.7 to 1. what was that?
For what assume, I'm sorry, Mark, they measure, that's for what?
A bunch of different groups.
What are mega matter?
0.3.
0.3.
It's a bunch of different groups, and they quote numbers anywhere from 0.7 through to 1.
Well, that's not bad.
Okay. Given how hard this is.
Can you cross-correlate the spin field with the shear tensor? The calculation that they use to bound A or get information about A is you're linking the correlation of the spins, as if it's a linear process, I can imagine, to the shear field.
Yep.
So that A is telling you the strength of the linear process that goes from the shear to the spin.
Yes.
Can you make some quantity out of L and T that you can measure to look for, as if the process is nonlinear?
If it's nonlinear?
Well, I don't know.
So this is the closest. This is what we do. It's a quadratic. What you get is a quadratic combination. This depends on T, and this depends on L. So it's L, T squared L squared is an estimator for A. And you're saying, are there higher order ones? Or?
Well, I was T L squared.
Yeah. Or L squared T.
L contracted.
Well, if you only have one T, then by symmetry, if T changes sign, L squared does not change sign. So that's always zero. So there are no odd powers.
Okay, I can contract my indices in some other way. LLTP.
Actually, I couldn't. There's a lot of symmetry, right? T only appears once, and you have to multiply T with itself, and all of the contractions go to zero. There are only like four ways or something of contracting it, and all the other ones never stick around. So that's the only one it's quadratic order that we could, that I've been able to construct. That is LLTT.
Basically what you get. Okay, assuming they decompose. And Lander is T.
Yeah, so that is LLTT. And you could have contracted L against T itself, but that's zero. So two things which are zero don't give you anything. And T, you can only, it's symmetric, so you cannot, there's no other way of multiplying T with itself.
I know we're short on time, I just wondered, what is the controversy?
Is this unique? I mean, is this kind of expression unique or not?
I was asking a different question. At the end, you kept saying, well, I got this, but Martin disagreed with that, and whatever. I just wondered, what's the controversy? I mean, can you say quickly?
Oh, McKee. What's his name? Mackey.
Yeah.
Mackey et al. Had argued that that one can have a analysis in which the E's and B's can actually differ significantly at large separations, I believe, was the conclusion.
Len Wee has waded into the fray now with the claim that everyone's misestimating the large angle.
Yes, indeed.
The large one?
The intrinsic alignments of large angles. He claims there's a second order effect, which while formally second order and thus in principle small, is numerically larger.
Whoa.
So he claims that, if you shift to the plots that Whaley showed, the intrinsic alignments are falling off quite rapidly.
Yeah, but he argues that they don't fall as quickly as they should.
In fact, they fall off one whole power slower than those plots.
Yeah.
So it really basically tracks the falling lines in line rather than.
So hopefully we'll know at least in the simulation soon. We're analyzing this 4 billion particle simulation now to see whether at least the Hiller correlation drops off as at large temperature. I mean, it's hard to measure it. Don't have a lot of halos to measure. But hopefully we'll be able to put a few more points on the map from simulations.
And then there's the totally unknown question of what the baryons do inside the halo. Preliminary measurements show that they're quite decorrelated.
Even though, of course, Curie and Asanta and Cholet are going to tell us tomorrow how correlated they are.
OK.
Okay, well, maybe we can thank Willie again.